From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Tales of the South Bronx from Abraham Rodriguez. He's just written his first collection of short stories. He's always loved to read and write, which are just two of the reasons he was considered a freak in his neighborhood. His Alice Cooper t-shirt was a third. Lucky for him, he could talk circles around anyone, including the gang members who wanted to beat him up. Also today, we'll talk to David Clennon. You may remember him from his role on 30-something as the power-hungry ad executive Miles Drentel. Now he's in the new Paul Schrader movie, Light Sleeper. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new albums by Betty Carter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. European stock markets were unusually active today in response to the Bundesbank's decision to lower interest rates. The decision to cut rates by half a percentage point was especially welcome in France for those who are campaigning for a yes vote on an important referendum next Sunday. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Traders were busy on the Paris stock market today as the German Bundesbank lowered the interest rates for the first time in 5 years. The German banker's decision was an important sign to those who support European unity, a mark of European cooperation. On Sunday, French voters cast their ballot in a referendum on a treaty known for the Dutch town of Maastricht, where the European community negotiated the pact. The polls in France had shown the no votes gaining ground, in part because of fears that the strong Deutschmark would dominate currency markets in Europe. Germany's foreign minister said he thought lower interest rates would have a positive effect on French voters. Germany is a strong proponent of European political and economic union. However, while the German decision moved the Paris market, it's not clear if French voters care much about interest rates. In Paris, this is Deborah Amos.
The Bush Quayle campaign is refusing to debate Democratic contender Bill Clinton under the terms proposed by the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. The commission has proposed a series of three debates, each to be conducted by a single moderator. The Bush campaign says it wants the same terms that were agreed on with the Dukakis campaign in 1988. Under that plan, there were two presidential debates with questions posed by three panelists. Clinton has already agreed to the bipartisan commission's plan. The Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, has been suffering one of its heaviest artillery bombardments since the war began. At least four people have been killed and 50 wounded. Senior United Nations military officers said that much of the artillery fire had come from Serbian positions, which had not been disclosed to the UN in breach of an agreement made at a London conference. Alan Little reports for the BBC.
The Bosnians said the Serbs had launched an infantry assault at Krasno in an attempt to cut the city in half. The head of the French UN contingent here, Colonel Armil Davu, said the Serbs had fired from guns they have kept hidden and not placed under UN observation, an unmistakable breach of the London Agreement, which came into effect only 2 days ago. Another senior officer was less circumspect. It's simple, he said, they're liars. The Bosnian government said it would not attend the Geneva peace talks. The joint chairman of the conference, Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen, gave the Serbs till last Saturday to observe the London Agreement. But they did not say what they would do if, as has clearly happened, the Serbs failed or refused. Today's events now force that question.
Alan Little in Sarajevo. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 71 points today to close at 3,376. This is NPR. School officials in Detroit have asked a judge to force striking teachers back to work. The strike has kept the city's 168,000 students out of school for 2 weeks. And the president of the teachers' union said that the school board cut off negotiations yesterday after teachers rejected a proposed 3% salary hike. The teachers are asking for 8%. The owner of a North Carolina chicken processing plant has pleaded guilty to 25 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Emmett Rowe owned the Imperial Food Products plant in Hamlet, North Carolina, where 25 people were killed in a fire last September. For member station WUNC, Adam Hochberg reports.
Rowe was sentenced to 20 years of active jail time for the manslaughter conviction. His guilty plea was part of a plea bargain with the district attorney. In exchange for Rowe pleading guilty, manslaughter charges were dropped against two other company officials, one of them Rowe's son. Survivors of the fire, such as Canester Williams, said the plea bargain was too lenient. She said each of the defendants should have received the maximum sentence of 250 years in prison.
There was a black person that killed all these people. We all would have been locked up.
That's right.
But right now, they're only giving these men, this man, 1 year per person, and it's not right.
Fire investigators said the victims were trapped in the burning building because the fire doors were locked to keep workers from stealing chickens. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Rockingham, North Carolina.
The nation's second largest physicians group called today for the reform of the health care system with a proposal that's very similar to the one offered by Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton. The proposal was advanced by the American College of Physicians, which represents about 77,000 doctors of internal medicine. It calls on the federal government to limit the amount of money spent overall on health care. The White House says there's not a chance that the president would endorse such a proposal. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Urban youth culture has a literary language, but it's usually rap music, not literature. My guest Abraham Rodriguez is trying to get that urban sound on the page. He's lived in the South Bronx all his life, and now he's writing about the people he grew up with. Many of them got hooked on drugs and became teenage parents. Some of them are already dead. Rodriguez has been writing since he was a kid. He's won several short story awards, and his first collection, The Boy Without a Flag, has just been published. The first story is autobiographical, about a Puerto Rican-American boy who refuses to salute the flag. The rest of the stories are about the kids he says most people see as the enemy.
I always felt writing this kind of material that there really wasn't any place else that I could find this kind of material. I mean, I've never seen it anywhere. Growing up in school, I never read it anywhere, really. I was never exposed to a Hispanic writer like Peary Thomas or something, who is Puerto Rican, who wrote a book somewhat like this ages ago. And because I also felt that the kind of world that this represents is a real world. It's happening. It's something that a lot of kids are trapped in, and nobody's really given a voice to it, you know, so I felt really motivated to just write some kind of stories that I could really relate to, that I think other kids can relate to, too, in that sense, you know.
There's a passage that I want you to read from your new collection of stories. Tell us something about the character before you read it.
Okay, this story is called Babies, and it's about a girl, a 16-year-old girl who's a heroin addict who's just found out she's pregnant. She hasn't told the guy she's living with yet. They're both addicts. And knowing that she's pregnant has sent her into this whole sort of a reevaluation of her whole life and thinking about babies and growing up and stuff like that. And that's pretty much what the story is about, when, you know, coming to the decision that she has to make about whether she's going to have a baby or not, and whether it would be wise to have a baby or not, considering her condition.
Now, before you read this, I should say that we changed some of the language, because you do use a lot of street language.
Yeah.
Because that's the language that your characters speak in. So we toned that down.
Somewhat.
But I should say before you read it that the language that you're using and the expletives that you use in it have a kind of musical function too, in a way.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I think that it happens with a lot of writing that really works, you know, like when you read a book that you pick it up and it just carries you right along. It's like a kind of rhythm thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good book is like a great song or a great music. It affects your heart like a kind of sound, like a kind of rhythm, you know. And people talking on the street have a kind of rhythm, you know. And I'm trying to capture that. I think I'm getting a little better at it as I go along. But I'm trying to capture that rhythm. And then it's also hard to capture that rhythm as people speak it and then write it, so that when you read it in the book, it doesn't just screw you up. Like, oh my God, what's all this stuff? You know, I can't read this. You know, it's kind of tricky to also put it down in words so that people can read it and get that musical feeling without their eyes tripping over it, you know?
Right, I know what you mean. Well, let me ask you to do the reading, and this is from Abraham Rodriguez's new collection of short stories, The Boy Without a Flag, Tales of the South Bronx.
I hate it when people say I'm a junkie and shit, because it's really not true. I know I got it all under control, and plus, I know I can stop anytime I want. I did once, for 3 whole days, And then, since I knew I could take it or leave it, I took it. Because, I mean, what else is there? Why shouldn't I feel sweet? Some Hispano been asking me where I picked up such a habit. Because around 149th, there ain't no 16-year-old girls on H. The fact is, I used to hang out in the village with this funky guy named Matt who used to do crazy stuff like steal cars for a day just to ride around. I met him through a friend in junior high. Me and him used to hang out a lot in that park with the big white arch thing where he used to deal H to all the junkies who hung there. I asked him what it was like to take H, because I seen him sniffing it, and he gave me a book to read, Christian F. I read like 4 pages and said, to hell with that. I hate books. He got mad and said I should learn something. But I wouldn't go near it again. So he said, screw it. I should learn the hard way then. He shot me full of H. I felt like I was gonna throw up on him. My stomach was dribbling around and my head felt like it was separating from my body. I got real nervous until Matt told me to relax and not be uptight. And then I started feeling real good. The next day, he shot me up again and made a joke about that being my last free sample. When that freeze hit me, I was on cloud 9, 10, 11. I was free of everything that bugged my head out, like my mother, who was out screwing like a dog in heat, or my bad grades in school, or my older brother, who one day disappeared without even a poof, leaving only a pair of Pro-Keds on the kitchen table as a goodbye. Nah, I wasn't thinking about nothing at all, just getting more sweet H and taking more trips into that sweet nothing land. I had to keep shooting after that. One time I bought some real bad shit from some guy I didn't know, a freaking Latin dude, and it was awful. I felt like if bugs were crawling all over and I couldn't stop scratching. That was the only time I ever got whacked. That was about a year ago that I turned on, I mean. And since then, I haven't gotten the sunken face or the bags under the eyes or the circles, neither. I look great. In fact, guys keep asking me out all the time, but I got my smiley, so I say nah. I'd only be like my mother if I said yeah.
You really read well. You're a performer too, aren't you?
No. you know, you grow up around it, so you're just able to turn it on, you know.
Is this story based on someone who you know?
Yeah, I've known girls like this. I've known people like this. A lot of the people in the book are based on real people, real kids, really. They're all kids, you know. So they're not like, you know, really old people experienced, but just sort of discovering this kind of thing for the first time, which makes it all the more tragic, I think.
Now, this story, did you show the story to the girl that it's based on?
I don't even know where she is, to be honest with you. It's loosely based on a girl that I knew, and, you know, how much of it is her and isn't, it would be, you know, it'd be hard to really say right off. But there is a lot of her life and the kind of struggle that she went through when, you know, she decided to have a baby, you know. It's a big decision for a girl. And again, like, I've never seen it written anywhere. I've never seen, you know, the kind of girls that I met when I was growing up, because almost all my best friends when I was growing up were girls, were going through this kind of stuff. And I felt that these girls were almost like heroic in a way, you know, the way that they had to make these heavy decisions and, you know, fight and claw to just survive out there. You know, I felt that was really heroic, and I never saw it written down anywhere. I never saw anybody really, you know, focus on it and give these girls the kind of attention that they deserved, or even more, that these kind of stories might inspire other girls, or at least make other girls think about the kind of decisions they're making, you know. I never saw it anywhere, and it was one of the reasons I think that got me to start really writing about it, you know, because I felt that they were like heroes, heroines.
My guest is Abraham Rodriguez. His first collection of short stories, The Boy Without a Flag, has just been published. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Abraham Rodriguez about his new collection of short stories. You grew up in the South Bronx. Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
It's pretty much the same kind of neighborhood I live in now. I still live in the Bronx. But when I was growing up, when I was very young, there were just a lot of people, a lot of kids, a lot of families, rows of tenements, and it was more of a community when I was growing up. Sometime in the 70s, they started burning everything. Everything started going. And then we had just like lots of abandoned buildings and empty lots and the usual sort of ghetto kind of thing, which a lot of people feel is cliche, but which is still going on, you know, the junkies and the drug addicts. And of course, when I was growing up, we had, you know, gangs. We had street gangs like the Savage Skulls and the Spanish Mafia and the Dirty Dozen and these kind of things. You know, the cats would have these little Lee jackets with the insignia on the back and all this corny stuff. And now that we don't have that, now what we have is, I guess, a little worse, which is just posses, which are, you know, groups of young kids who run around and usually heavily armed and probably three times more dangerous than when I was growing up. But it's pretty much the same burg. It's the same kind of experience. You got the same kind of wasted lives. You got the same kind of people out there on the streets doing the same kind of hustling, the same kind of criminal activity, the same kind of hurt, the same kind of pain. You know, it's just the same thing, you know, and you got your people in the midst of all of that who are honest, you know, God-fearing, hard-working poor people who are just trying to, like, bring up their kids so they don't end up that way. You know, same old story.
What was your family like when you were growing up? Was your family together? Were both of your parents around?
Yeah, my family's pretty tight-knit. I mean, you know, we're still together pretty much except for my sister because she got married. But very tight-knit family, very supportive parents. I was kind of a spoiled kid, you know. Always at home. I didn't hang out on the street very much. I was always into books and the Beatles, so I sort of grew up in my house, you know, for a long time because I grew up in love with books and writing. You know, my father got me into writing because he was a poet and used to type a lot. This was the first sound I remember hearing when I was little. That's part of the whole Boy Without a Flag thing, you know, hearing the typewriter and really liking that sound, you know. And my father used to use typewriters, big ones, used to rent them. And I just loved that sound, you know, and I started typing. I just had to sit on his lap and type some. And then I just liked it so much that, you know, eventually I begged and pleaded for portable. And then I started bashing out my own kind of stories and things. But that was like when I was really little, like, you know, 10 or 11 years old. It's just a typewriter fixation, really. It's really all about typewriters, this whole thing. You know?
It's like your instrument.
Yeah, I just love them. I just love typewriters. And manuals, mind you, not the electric stuff.
So your father writes poetry. Has he been published?
No, my father, you know, my father's always done the right thing. In essence, he's done what's always necessary. When he first came to this country, you know, he's a wide-eyed Latin kid. He went into the army right away, learned English in the army. He learned how to roller skate in the army. Hey, America, where else, you know? But after he got out of the army, he just wanted to get into all this kind of art stuff. He was into getting into acting. He got into radio. He worked in what's now Spanish radio. He was pretty much in the, you know, the bottom floor of that when it was just getting started. And he quit. He quit like a lot of the things he was into because family. You know, his family was always pressuring him, saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing this artsy stuff. You should be doing something serious, like working the counter at Needix. You know, that's serious. Or getting yourself a full-time job, that's serious. So my father, little by little, gave up a lot of his dreams, you know. And one of the biggest dreams, I think, was being a poet. He used to write all the time. Well, growing up, I remember, I mean, I still have folders of his poetry, you know, Spanish stuff. Really romantic stuff about the island and women and, you know, Pablo Neruda type of things. And, you know, that's basically where I got it. He was like my big inspiration, but he didn't get published. He never pursued it. By the time that I was around, you know, he had already given up the idea of even becoming a poet, like being published and stuff. He just did it because he loved it. And, you know, it was, I think it was a form of release for him. And unfortunately for him, I picked it up right away. And so, you know, that probably created more problems for him, I imagine, because then he's the one telling me, you should do something serious.
So was your father supportive of your writing, or did he want you to do a quote, serious job too?
Yeah, my parents are supportive. I mean, they've supported me when I wasn't working, and they've supported me in every... They still support me in many ways. You know, I mean, they're very supportive, but my father was really... I think it was just the fear of having me, like, end up sort of like him, you know, even though he wouldn't put it that way. But the idea that I would end up, you know, because I didn't pursue everything that I should have in school, for example, you know, making a career for myself in some serious way. He was always into making me become a lawyer or a doctor or something serious, you know, something money-making, something lucrative, so you don't have to worry about money. And I did everything I could to frustrate that. I just went the other way. I just wanted to write and make music and do all the things that don't make money.
What was it like for you growing up, loving to read, loving to write, listening to the Beatles, in the South Bronx, where I think people were much more kind of physical, being tough probably was very important. I'm sure... Reading was considered pretty unimportant as a survival skill in your neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, I was pretty much a freak when I was growing up, in the sense of, you know, see, like, for example, back then, you know, the early 70s, you know, rock and roll wasn't like it is now, where, you know, you have Hispanics like rock and roll and everybody likes rock and roll. Rock and roll means like 8 million different things. You know, back then, rock and roll was white music. It was honky music. You didn't like rock and roll. If you were growing up in the South Bronx, you know, that wasn't your scene. Well, I loved rock and roll. I was into rock music, so I was a rock freak. Okay, I had the torn jeans. My hair was too long. I liked the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the whole thing. You know, Alice Cooper T-shirts. I mean, I was really out of I was really out of my element, all right? I was really, really asking for trouble. And then, on top of that, I liked books. All right, that's the worst. I mean, okay, you have no taste in music, fine. Okay, we can live with that. But then you're, like, reading and stuff. I was always walking around with books and stuff. The first book that I read cover to cover was William L. Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Okay, come on, the kid must be cracked. All right? Even my teachers thought I was strange. You know, they were like, wow, this kid reads books. You know, you be cool around him, you know. So I was always an outsider in that sense. And that got worse as I got older. I mean, because, you know, in the sense of, you know, I read, I talked differently than other kids. Kids used to say, well, you know, I'm Jewish because, you know, my name's Abraham Rodriguez, and because I use $10 words, and because I talk with my hands. You can't see my hands, right? But they're moving. And they say, you know, well, Jews talk with their hands. And look at his nose. He's got a big nose. And, you know, so I was like a Jewish kid growing up, really. Even though I'm not Jewish, they used to think, oh, you know, he's this Jew guy, Jew freak. And, you know, I started reading Philip Roth, you know, because it's true. I started reading Philip Roth, you know, all those parts in Philip Roth where he's saying, I was measuring my nose up against the table, you know, to see how long it was. And I'm doing the Jewish test, you know, because I'm saying, like, is it me? You know, it's a sort of identity crisis there that I went through with Philip Roth, because, you know, he's the first real fiction I ever read, because I was just reading history books and stuff. But, you know, I had a real identity kind of crisis thing. I didn't feel very Latin in that sense, and I grew up that way for a long time. I was pretty much alone, so books and records were really, really, you know, I used to hang out with books and records. That's how I grew up. And girlfriends. I had a lot of girlfriends, but not girlfriends like, yo, man, that's a fine fox. It was more like, you know, she's my friend. She come over to me, hey, Orlando hit me, you know, and I'm like, oh, why'd he do that? You know, you should find somebody that won't hit you. She's like, I love him. You know, it's this kind of thing. So I was a best friend. You know, I patted down her tears. I gave her a hug. Yeah, go back to him. You know, next time, don't tell him he's a fool. You know, it's this kind of thing. So, you know, that's where a lot of the stories come from, me hanging with these incredible girls. I mean, I knew a lot of incredible girls, you know, as friends. We weren't, like, involved.
So when you were a teenager and people were supposed to kind of be able to physically defend themselves and everything. What did you do?
Oh, well, I was smart. See, I could talk my way out of fights. I knew people who wanted to kick my butt, but, you know, I could talk my way around them. I mean, words were my thing, you know. So I could talk my way. I must have talked my way out of, like, 30 or 40 big major scrapes.
Is there one you can think of that you could tell us about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew this kid called Nelson who's I don't know where he is now, God bless him, but he used to be in the Savage Skulls, you know, and he didn't like me. He didn't like me for a long time. I don't exactly remember what it was that got him to really despise me. It could have been the Alice Cooper T-shirt. I remember that pissed him off. But, you know, he cornered me one day in the lockers downstairs, like in the basement where they had the cafeteria. And he says, like, I'm going to, you know, I can't say what he said. But he was going to do it, I swear, because he, you know, once he said that, you knew he was going to do it. And so after school, you know, we all got together outside for this beating. You know, I'm sure they sold tickets and stuff. There's a little waiting line and everything. And he was going to beat the hell out of me, but I talked him out of it. I just told him, look, you know, let's be honest about this, you know. Okay, me, I'm just a wimp. You can kick my butt, you know. And I just talked him out of it. I started talking about friendship and life and I don't know. I even mentioned Hitler at one point, you know, Poland. I brought everything in, you know, because I could just talk circles around. And the guy's waiting for me. This was his mistake. He was waiting for me to finish. So he's like, yeah, that's true. All right, you finished yet? I'm like, no, because that's the preamble. And then I just go on into, you know. So finally he just like, you know, we ended up shaking hands and all this. Because we started talking, I don't know how we got into English and stuff. But then I started saying, well, you know, I was talking to the teacher and she says, well, you know, your English isn't that good. And he's like, yeah, I know. I got an F on my report. And so I say, well, look, man, look, I'll help you with the report. That's no problem. You know, I can help you with that crap. It's easy. Believe me. And so I ended up helping him out. You know, I ended up hanging with some Savage Skull guy because I could help him with English. So, you know, I found ways around it. You know, the whole macho thing and having to beat people up and all this and show your manhood. I sort of found other ways around it, you know. I didn't eat into the whole thing, really. I just wanted to not get beaten up. But it wasn't that heavy for me. I don't know why, but, you know, I wasn't confronted with that kind of scene that much. And, I mean, I'm probably playing it up more because I want to seem, like, real gutsy. But it really wasn't that bad. I mean, I never really, of all the fights I could have been in, I figure maybe one or two were, like, really serious. Mm-hmm. Everything else was just, you know, school kid kind of crap.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Like, you say that you talk differently from most of the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Most of your stories, which are about other people, are really written in the kind of street language that you don't necessarily speak yourself. But I guess you were listening the whole time that you weren't speaking that way yourself.
Yeah,
and really picked up on it as a writer.
That's the prudential. That's the piece of the rock right there. Yeah, you know, you're always soaking stuff in. You know, when I finally got to college, I remember I was still writing. I wrote a lot about Germans and World War II and, you know, stories of the Eastern Front. This collection should be stories of the Eastern Front, you know. I was infatuated with German soldiers and all this. And when I got to college, the first story that I won an award with was a story about a German sniper behind enemy lines. I remember meeting Ed Rivera, who's a Hispanic writer and probably my mentor, I guess, because I got a lot from him when I was there. And he told me, look, you know, I had written Elba at that time, and I think Babies was already written. And he read some of it and he said, look, you know, you should really write more about what you know about. You know, I mean, the Eastern Front is fine and everything, but come home. You know, it's basically come home from the Eastern Front because the stories are all around you and you can write them. You know, these stories that you wrote now, you know, you capture it. You can write it. You should look around you. And I started at that point, I started to really think more about what I had in the South Bronx and the stories that there were in the South Bronx and how the stories were not being told. You know, there was nobody writing them.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. It was an honor.
Abraham Rodriguez, his first collection of short stories, The Boy Without a Flag, is published by Milkweed Editions of Minneapolis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As Miles Drentel on the series 30-something, David Clennon gave a convincing portrayal of an ad executive whose life revolved around power, money, and success. Now Clennon plays a low-key drug dealer in the new movie Light Sleeper, which stars Willem Dafoe and Susan Sarandon. Coming up, we'll talk with Clennon about his TV and movie roles. Also, jazz singer Betty Carter has a new album and a new reissue. Kevin Whitehead has reviews of both. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As residents of the Hawaiian island of Kauai pick through rubble left by Hurricane Iniki, the military is stepping up its efforts to provide relief for those who lost their homes. Scott Kim of member station KHPR reports.
Almost 3 days after the storm blasted through, Kauai citizens and government officials are slowly restoring the island's infrastructure. Major Wayne Yoshioka, spokesman for the Department of Defense, says the military is setting up distribution centers around the island.
Right now we're working on getting our distribution centers set up in four areas where the public can go for ice, as well as for the repair goods like the plastic sheeting.
Yoshioka says about 70% of the island now has running water, but he says electricity is not expected to be restored for another week. Iniki hit Kauai with sustained winds of 145 miles per hour and sea swells of 20 to 30 feet. At least four deaths have been attributed to circumstances surrounding the storm. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Kim in Honolulu.
President Bush told a campaign audience at a Washington State lumber mill today that he would not sign an extension of the Endangered Species Act unless it gives more consideration to jobs. This announcement was part of an attack that the president made on what he called extremist views on the environment. Lee Garnett of Northwest Public Radio reports.
Surrounded by stacks of lumber, President Bush told his audience of mostly timber workers in Colville, Washington, that the Endangered Species Act is broken and must be fixed.
It is time we worried not only about the endangered species, but about endangered jobs. Jobs in the timber industry and in agriculture and in transportation and in recreation as well.
Mr. Bush quoted from Senator Al Gore's book, where Gore wrote that he was proud of leading the fight to save the spotted owl. The president's message was well received in this area, where lawsuits over spotted owl protection have been blamed for layoffs at lumber mills. He was interrupted briefly, though, by a small crowd of hecklers who shouted, "What about AIDS?" For National Public Radio, this is Lee Garnett reporting.
President Bush says he will debate Democratic presidential challenger Bill Clinton if Clinton accepts the same terms as set back in 1988. Two meetings with three panelists asking questions. Clinton has agreed to a different plan made by the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. Three meetings with a single moderator. A spokesman for the Clinton campaign said today, it's time for the Republican ticket to quit running and hiding and come out and debate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 70 points to close at 3,376.22. On volume of more than 251 million shares, trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In North Carolina, the owner of a chicken processing plant has entered guilty pleas to 25 counts of involuntary manslaughter in connection with a fire 1 year ago that killed 25 people. Emmett Rowe has been sentenced to nearly 20 years in prison. As a result, the state has dropped charges against two plant managers, including Roe's son. An attorney for the elder Roe said his client pleaded guilty to save his family. A draft report from Congress says that the U.S. military is taking effective steps to combat sexual harassment. The study was prompted by a scandal at last year's so-called Tailhook Association, the convention of Navy flyers in Las Vegas, where several women were sexually assaulted. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
The report criticizes the naval aviation community for a lack of oversight and goes on to say that the scale of sexual harassment and assault at last year's Tailhook Convention was unique, though the cultural attitude that made it possible is not. And it concludes that the scandal finally forced the Pentagon to get serious about a pervasive problem. Wisconsin Democrat Les Aspin, who chairs the House Armed Services Committee, says the military now offers instructional and counseling programs, and the top brass now makes it clear that sexual harassment, like racial harassment, will cost people their promotions or even their jobs.
When it's that kind of commitment, then you see the change.
But the report suggests that it might be difficult to resolve issues of sexual equality completely if the military continues to deny women access to frontline combat jobs. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
Government officials have announced a $1.15 billion aid plan for Russia. This plan calls for loan guarantees and other efforts to buy food, despite some concern over Moscow's ability to pay back the money. About $100 million in guarantees will be made available this month. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz singer Betty Carter began singing professionally in the mid-1940s in the Lionel Hampton Band, in which she was known as Betty Bebop Carter. The great Betty Carter is still very active in jazz, performing at clubs, concert halls, and festivals, and making new records. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's a confirmed fan.
Tightly in your arms tonight. Say you love me, say you need me. Give my heart a thrill, oh honey, please. Say you'll never stop. If it's love you want, then you can have all. Oh, God.
That's Betty Carter, recorded in the mid-1980s, slinking around a melody in her best modern manner. To me, Carter's the best jazz singer working now and one of the great bebop improvisers on any instrument. She has a good new album out, appropriately titled It's Not About the Melody. But I'm more excited about a recent reissue of Carter's recordings from 1958 and 60.
All I've got is just a lot of romance for a guy like you. Although I'm shy, I'm not denying, I'm trying to prove my love is true. It would please me if you squeeze me tightly in your arms tonight. Say you love me, say you need me. Give my heart a thrill of delight. Oh, honey, please say you'll never stop. If it's love you want, then you can have all I've got.
That tune is All I've Got by Diane Cole. The CD I Can't Help It on the Impulse label combines two of the earliest LPs Betty Carter made under her own name. Her voice was lighter then, and the tempos a little more varied than they are on her new album. She didn't stretch melodies quite as far as she does now, but even then, she broke the old jazz singer's rule that says you're supposed to sing a tune straight before improvising on it. Carter could never wait that long.
You're mean to me. Why must you be mean to me? Johnny, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why stay home each night when you say you phone. Yeah, don't think I'm left alone, singing the blues and crying. You treat
the settings Betty Carter appears in on these vintage recordings range from sextet to big band, sometimes with strings added. A couple of pieces are a little overblown without slowing her down any, but a lot of them have the kind of crackle modern bebop often lacks.
By the bend of the river, where rushes are growing and waters are flowing far down to the sea, on a soft balmy tuna in the shimmering moonlight, I know that my own true love is waiting for me. cool of the evening, when the shadows are falling, I can hear my love calling so softly to me, to the scent of the heaven, and there's some of heaven. We'll get down together, my true love and me.
That's By the Bend of the River, written by Clara Edwards. Betty Carter is one jazz woman who's given exposure to her sisters. Some of the arrangements here are by trombonist Melba Liston. Most of these performances have aged extremely well. Even an unintentionally hilarious manifesto from a time when jazz was falling out of favor called Jazz Ain't Nothing But Soul. Jazz singing is making a comeback, in name at least. This year we've had major label debuts by Nina Freelon, Patricia Barber, and Vanessa Rubin, none of them worthy to hail Betty Carter a taxicab. Even Cassandra Wilson, at her best the most talented of younger jazz singers, falls far short when she tries to scat sing like Carter. Betty Carter is one of a kind, and that was as true in 1960 as it is now.
Making do with taters and grits, standing up each time you get hit. Jazz ain't nothing but soul. Jazz is living high off nickels and dimes, telling folks about what's on your mind. Jazz ain't nothing but soul. Trumpets, cusses, saxophone, rhythm.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He wrote the discography for the new edition of The Jazz Book, published by Lawrence Hill. This is Fresh Air. Say the name Miles Drentel, and many baby boomers still recoil. Drentel was the advertising executive on the TV series 30-something, a character who raised the art of intimidation to new heights by melding capitalist power games with Zen inscrutability. Drentel was played by my guest actor David Clennon. Since 30-something ended its run on TV, I've seen Clennon in two roles and barely recognized him in them because the characters were so different. He played a witty writer dying of AIDS on the HBO series Dream On. And now he co-stars as a low-key drug dealer in Paul Schrader's new film Light Sleeper. Clennon, Willem Dafoe, and Susan Sarandon play three drug dealers in New York who are looking to get out of the business because it's been ruined by crack. Schrader portrays the dealer as a kind of priest or therapist entering the inner life of each person he sells to. I wanted to know if Schrader talked to the cast about his vision of the drug dealer.
We talked about the culture, the world that these people move in before we even started shooting. We had some time to read through, and we actually had some time to rehearse all of the scenes that we shot in Anne's apartment, or the apartment belonging to Susan Sarandon's character. So we had, you know, discussed quite a bit about the drug culture and the drug world. And the main reason why I was excited about doing the film was that it was, well, first it was, I thought, brilliantly written and unusual and a new perspective. But what was most remarkable to me was that Schrader was looking at the drug culture and at drug dealers without participating in the hysteria that goes on in this country around drugs. I think drug addiction is a serious problem in this country, and there's a tremendous amount of violence that surrounds the traffic in drugs. And I think that the approach that's been taken by the authorities in this country to dealing with the problem is completely wrong-headed. And I appreciated that Paul Schrader, looking at this situation from the inside and from his own experience, corroborated by my experience, was saying that people involved in this are human beings. They're not satanic creatures who should be taken out and shot.
Did you have a lot of experience with that?
With drugs?
And with suppliers?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used a lot of drugs from about 1965 till sometime in 81. And in my experience, the criminalization of drugs didn't stop me from using drugs. The threat of being busted or imprisoned wasn't a deterrent to me. What became a deterrent finally was the realization that I was wasting a lot of energy and corrupting my talent and risking my life.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your life. One of the things you've talked about in print before is that you were arrested several times, I think 9 times, all for, I believe, political reasons over the years. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you were arrested for? Was it mostly demonstrations?
Well, sitting in at the Pentagon in 1967, October of 67, I guess, was the first time that I was arrested, and then I was openly and publicly resisting the draft for a couple of years after that. And I dropped out from about 1970 to 1980. I dropped out of political activism, and then in the 80s I got involved in the struggles around El Salvador and Nicaragua.
In college you were in ROTC, which is a military program. How did you get from a military program to political protests that were anti-military in nature?
I had 2 years of Army ROTC in high school in Waukegan, Illinois. I think it was the last high school in the country that had a mandatory military training program. And I wanted to be an astronaut when I went to college. But when I was a freshman in that course, I just found the authoritarian military mindset too hard, too difficult to take. I couldn't subordinate myself to their way of thinking and their demands for total compliance.
What was
I dropped out of the Air Force ROTC.
Did you rebel while you dropped out? Did you drop out in a rebellious way?
Yeah, I refused to answer some questions the way they wanted me to answer them.
What does that mean?
Well, we were supposed to. When we were having an inspection one day, and I always had trouble getting a good shine on my shoes and good polish on my brass, and a lot of the kids in the program had the same problem. But during an inspection, we were supposed to answer all of our questions with a sir at the beginning and a sir at the end, and I got it into my head that was too many sirs. And it was too subservient to the to these 20-year-old kids who were trying to intimidate us. So I, somebody said, "Mr. Clennon, you don't have a spit shine on your shoes." I said, "No, sir. And, brass isn't polished." "No, sir." And so they, after a few answers, they realized that I wasn't giving them enough sirs. So they came down on me and surrounded me and started screaming at me and eventually court-martialed me. It was a real tempest in a teapot.
Can you be court-martialed for not saying sir?
For not saying sir, yes, sir, or sir, no, sir. I told him I thought one sir was sufficient to, express my respect for their authority, but I didn't see the need for two. And
what were the official charges?
Freaked out. Some kind of insubordination, I think. Mm-hmm. So I got busted from airman third class down to airman basic. There was really, it was a pretty trivial incident, although it was loaded with lots of fear and anger on both sides.
I guess what I find interesting about this in terms of your acting career, take your role as Miles Drentel on 30-something. He's a pretty authoritarian guy, this character that you are playing. I mean, not exactly in the military mold, but in the area of business, he was pretty authoritarian and very sure of himself. Do you feel like you borrowed anything from the military guys whose authority you rejected when you were creating the Miles Drentel character?
I might have, but I didn't think about it in those terms. I felt that most of the character was very clear on the pages of those scripts.
Mm-hmm.
The writers had done a really superb job, for the most part, in creating a very vivid character that you could imagine just by reading from the page and seeing the way he spoke and the actions that he took. And I didn't consciously employ anything that I had learned from the military experience that I'd had. I think, if anything, that character we're talking about would probably have been pretty contemptuous of most military discipline. He was much, I thought, much wilier and more manipulative than most military personnel that I've had experience with.
Do you think your politics affect the kind of films you're interested in working in and the kind of roles that you'll accept?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't interested in doing a Clint Eastwood movie about the Cold War because I thought it just fed that, you know, it fed the paranoia and it reinforced the propaganda. So that things like that, I don't want to do.
It's funny because in the two Costa Gavras films that I've seen you in, Betrayed and Missing, and in both of them you played people who were either representing the American administration, whose views in Central America you would be opposing yourself. You know, you, David Clennon, would be opposing. Mm-hmm. In Betrayed, you were a pretty right-wing guy.
Right-wing, Christian, fundamentalist, a real creep.
Well, how did you end up with the pro-administration and right-wing roles? Were those the roles you particularly wanted in the films?
Well, somebody's got to do those parts, and I think it's important that the villains in the stories that I want to tell, that the villains be absolutely convincing, that they be real flesh and blood people. You can say, I really despise what that State Department guy stands for, but I believe that people like that exist in the world.
I wonder if there are any frustrations that you feel at this point in your career being an actor who's known but not famous and who gets decent roles but not leading roles in movies.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, it's in some ways, I think you have to, if you want to break into that arena where you're the central character in the drama, I think you have to maybe create those situations yourself, collaborate with a writer maybe or a director. In the meantime, it's more, you know, it is interesting and rewarding to play characters that are maybe more sharply defined than leading characters that make, you hope are going to make an impression in a shorter period of time and have an impact on the way people see the story.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Darren.
David Clennon is featured in the new film Light Sleeper.
¶¶
This is Fresh Air. Lynn Near is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, NPR's Ina Jaffe has visited the Hawaiian island of Kauai, which was hit by Hurricane Iniki. So we'll be talking with her about some of the things she saw during her visit there, the damage, and the start of recovery. We'll also have a report on a draft report on sexual harassment in the military that was released today by a congressional committee. And NPR's Jim Zeroli has a report on the New York Democratic Senate primary, which has pitted two women against each other. One of them is Geraldine Ferraro, and the other is New York City Comptroller Elizabeth Holtzman.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tony Perkins died over the weekend at the age of 60. He had AIDS. Of course, Perkins will always be best remembered for his performance as Norman Bates in Psycho. He was so convincing in that role that people forget what else he was capable of. Many people didn't know what a good singer he was. He even recorded some records, and we're going to close the show with one of them. This was recorded in 1957, 1 year after Fear Strikes Out, 3 years before Psycho.
Somehow, someday, we'll be close together, wait and see. Oh, by the way, this time the dream's on me. You'll hold my hand, and you'll look at me adoringly. But as things stand, this time the dream's on me. It would be fun just pretending that I'm the one, to know that I at least supply the shoulder you cry upon, to see you through till you're everything you want to be. It can't be true, but this time the dream's on me. It would be fun just pretending that I'm the one, to know that I at least supply the shoulder you cry upon, see you through till you're everything you want to be. It can't be true, but this time the dream's on me. This time the dream's on me.
Tony Perkins recorded in 1957. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andrew Bergman about writing and directing the hit film Honeymoon in Vegas. Bergman also wrote and directed The Freshman, and he co-wrote Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.